When the COVID pandemic closed all schools and many businesses, a lot of us described our homebound existence as quarantine. A few people pointed out that the term was not being used exactly correctly. Our guest this hour can not only explain the term, but also its roots, both as a word and as a practice, and how far back in history it goes. Jeff Maynaugh and partner Nicola Twilley are the co-authors of Until Proven Safe, The History and Future of Quarantine, which gives us a tour of previous quarantines and even quarantine facilities around the world, including the little-known New American one in Nebraska. Jeff Maynaugh writes for several publications, created Building Blog, and is the author of A Burglar's Guide to the City. Nicola Twilley is a science journalist, co-hosts the podcast Gastropod, and contributes frequently to The New Yorker. They live together in Los Angeles. Jeff Maynaugh is our guest. Thank you for joining us, particularly on short notice. We didn't have you scheduled till yesterday.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So you guys apparently were well into writing the book when COVID-19 happened. This is not just a like, hey, let's do a book on quarantine because of COVID kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we'd been working on the book for several years at that point. And, you know, one of the things that we'd like to point out that was kind of funny was that when we actually sold the book to our editor, the title we had was The Coming Quarantine. You know, the idea that we kind of motivated us was that quarantine seemed like this obsolete and outdated practice, you know, something that might be from the Middle Ages. But in fact, it was going to become even more important in the future. And so that was really what motivated the book. And then when COVID-19 hit, and, you know, at one point, more than half the world's human population was in some state of either quarantine or lockdown. You know, we obviously had to find a new title because the quarantine had arrived.
Right. So here it was. So, yeah, no longer the future. The future is the present. Until Proven Safe, The History and Future of Quarantine is the title of the book now. And I have to believe that this is a story that the more you dug, the more you found. It just kept unfolding.
Yeah, that was one of the things that really motivated us to write the book. You know, as we started asking questions about quarantine, you know, what it was, how it had changed over time, why and where humans do it, you know, we just found it was all over the place. And it wasn't even just humans. You know, one of the ways we protect our food supply is through quarantine. You know, animals go into quarantine. You know, we use quarantine even for astronauts when they go to and from the International Space Station. So there's a whole division at NASA that's focused on what they call planetary protection, which is just a different kind of quarantine. And so, yeah, it was a lot of, and then on top of that, you know, the research took us around the world, you know, around the Mediterranean to Australia, to a lot of really interesting places. So quarantine, you know, went from seeming like an outdated practice to really kind of being everywhere.
Well, so given the fact that you were talking about the coming quarantine, I guess you weren't particularly surprised to see what happened with COVID, or were you?
Well, you know, we really weren't. It was only surprising, I guess, that it just happened so quickly. You know, we went from, you know, 0 to 60, you know, in the course of just a couple of weeks, all of a sudden, you know, the lockdowns were in entire cities were being sealed off in China. Then that spread to places like Italy, and we began to see it throughout Western Europe and then the United States. So the rapidity with which it happened was definitely, you know, pretty eye-opening. But the fact that it happened, I didn't think was too surprising. In fact, one of the things that was interesting was just how many mistakes were made, and that we see the same things throughout history, just in terms of authorities, you know, miscommunicating the nature of the disease threat, people maybe resisting or questioning quarantine orders, you know, the buildings for quarantine not being adequate for what they were being asked to do. These kinds of mistakes or these kinds of you know, errors have been made for centuries, and it was, you know, both interesting and kind of frustrating to see it happen during COVID-19.
Errors both on the part of the people in charge and the people who were supposed to comply, right? I mean, the people.
Yeah.
I mean, is this a fairly common thing in a quarantine? As people go out and plague shopping, I guess was one version of the term I heard.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, those kinds of things, you know, have really happened for centuries. I mean, you know, a good example of that was even in the origins of quarantine, you know, which was 600 years ago during the Black Death in Southern Europe. You know, people would take quarantine orders, and they would hear that, you know, maybe their neighbors had been put into quarantine and had been sent off to the central quarantine facility, leaving their house empty. Other people actually, you know, instead of taking that as a sign of danger or risk, they formed burglary crews and would actually break into the houses of the people who had been sent off to quarantine. And then sometimes, of course, the goods or the things that they stole from people's houses, you know, might have the fleas that transmitted the Black Death. Mm-hmm. And then they actually made the outbreak worse because they, you know, they stole these things and then sold them on the black market. So my point is just that, you know, people have always, you know, questioned official guidance or, you know, not trusted that maybe the danger was real. And then they've gone against public health guidance for, you know, and often pretty tragic results.
You report in the book that you were following a preppers group on the Telegram app. What kinds of things got discussed in that group?
That was interesting, and it was definitely a sign of things to come, I think. I joined that on the advice of a friend who knew that we were wrapping up the book. And, the idea of the group ostensibly was that these were people who were, you know, prepping not just for COVID-19, but for, mass societal disruptions, power outages, earthquakes, you know, whatever it might be, wildfires. You know, these were the people who would be, you know, holed up in their bunkers or living in the wilderness, and they would outlast everybody. But what was so interesting with COVID-19 was just that almost immediately it just became, you know, full of misinformation and people trading back and forth conspiracy theories that, you know, it wasn't a disease at all. It was an effect of 5G antenna towers being installed in Chinese cities in one case, someone actually posted film stills from a science fiction movie and mistook them for actual scenes of an authoritarian crackdown outside Moscow where people were being rounded up into quarantine. And so, you know, rumors, conspiracy theories, just pure misinformation, you know, even confusion about how to use Lysol cans, some pretty surprising things for a group of people that presented themselves as, you know, really being the tough ones who would outlive society. It was just almost comical to see that some of them couldn't do the most basic things like cleaning up their house or using Lysol.
Which is really weird when you consider the fact that we thought we believed in science maybe until 2 years ago, but you know, there's a lot more that we understand about how things move around, and yet we seem to blow it in our confusion.
It's true. Yeah, I think that's just one of the things that's happening these days, is there's a turn against expertise, and there's a belief that, you know, experts must have some sort of ulterior motive and that they're up to something else. And I think that kind of conspiracy, or not even conspiracy, but that sort of distrust has really been around for centuries when it comes to quarantine, because quarantine is such an easy power to abuse. You know, it thrives on uncertainty and thus can be subject to suspicion and bias. So a political power can just say, hey, you know, we think you might have this disease, or we suspect you might be contaminated or infected.
Okay, short
break. So we're going to order you into quarantine.
Until proven safe, back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Jeff Maynaw and partner Nicola Twilley were working on a book for several years about the history of quarantine, thinking about the next time it was going to happen, and right smack in the middle of the year in which they were supposed to publish the book, COVID-19 happened and actually caused situations like quarantine around the world. The book is now called Until Proven Safe, The History and Future of Quarantine. Jeff Maynaw is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, and you may join the conversation. You may have many questions for him about the history of quarantine and how it's been used and abused. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And Jeff, what do you know? The root of the word quarantine is actually fairly mundane.
It is actually. The funny thing with quarantine is that it really just means 40. It's 40 days. It comes from quarantena, which is a Venetian dialect for 40. And it's also interesting that before quarantine, before it was 40 days, it was 30 days, in which case it was a trentina. And so it moved from 30 to 40 because of there's a lot of biblical and cultural resonance with the idea of 40. You know, 40 years is the Hebrew length of a generation. It was 40 days of rain that flooded the world for Noah's Ark. Christ spent 40 days and nights in the desert. So just the number 40, you know, had a resonance with people. It was something that they could understand and really kind of made the idea of quarantine, that you go off for a little bit to see if you're safe, to see if you're infected, to see what, you know, to see to make sure you're not a threat to others. By tying that back to cultural or biblical history was a way to give it significance and to help it make sense for people.
Some biblical heft certainly helps in the Middle Ages in particular. And let's talk about a definition, though, because, I mean, obviously not just 40 days anymore, but quarantine as currently understood in the world today means what, and how does what happened during COVID differ?
Well, yeah, so that's a really interesting question. Quarantine is different from isolation. And the reason why is actually one of the things that kind of motivated our research to write the book. So quarantine requires uncertainty. If you don't know that you have a disease, or if you don't know that someone else has it, they might be a risk, but you're not sure, and you need to separate them or separate yourself, then that's quarantine. If you absolutely know that you have the infection, or if you know that someone else has an infection and they go into the hospital or they stay home, that isn't quarantine, that's isolation. And so what's pretty fascinating about that is that quarantine then, becomes a really metaphorically rich experience. You know, it's about the possibility that you have something inside of you and it might yet emerge. And when it does emerge, it's going to be a threat to other people. So because of that, you know, you can really kind of use quarantine as a great metaphor or even kind of a poetic way of looking at the world. And then with COVID-19, you know, there definitely were actual quarantines. You know, if you were exposed to COVID-19, but you weren't sure if you had it yet, and so you stayed home from work, or maybe you checked into a hotel room and didn't leave it for a week, those kinds of things, that was literal quarantine. It actually is quarantine. But for the most part, you know, when we started locking down businesses and closing different air routes and shutting down certain individual businesses altogether, you know, like I said, restaurants or, you know, maybe hotels or gyms, those were just lockdowns or attempts at isolation and not necessarily quarantine, the actual literal sense of the medical term.
So you mentioned already Black Death appears to be the first use of quarantine about 600 or so years ago. So we're talking bubonic plague here, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was the bubonic plague that broke out basically first around the Adriatic Sea region in the Venetian Republic.
And what's the best evidence of where Black Death might have originated?
Well, there's a couple ways that historians have really tried to track down where it came from, which is thought to be East Asia. There's actual, forensic material evidence that the germ was present in that region and can be found in old materials, almost archaeologically. But then there's also textual evidence. There are descriptions that people have written down over the years of outbreaks in cities that seem to be moving further west. There's even descriptions of a siege where plague infected corpses were flung over the castle walls as a kind of early bioweapon. And so catapults were just throwing infected bodies into the city, and they piled up in mountains. And allegedly, that's one of the first places where bubonic plague coming from those bodies, really kind of terrorized everybody, and they began fleeing, and then they brought the disease with them.
As you point out, science was not well-seeded in medieval Europe, so aside from flinging people over castle walls, I mean, what was the general approach to dealing with sick people, or was it very different from country to country?
It definitely was different. It was different region to region and culture to culture, and so one of the things we found even was that, you know, there were differences between Christianity and Islam. There were differences in different parts of Europe. One thing that quarantine did was it was really kind of an early step toward modern medicine. What happened was that authorities in the Adriatic Sea region, so cities like what is now called Dubrovnik or Venice itself, began to notice that when they did have an outbreak, it was generally preceded by the arrival of a ship, and that ship had goods on it, or it had a crew on it that had been to certain other parts of generally the Near East, you know, what would now be Turkey, that kind of thing, or Lebanon, Israel, that region. And so they decided, you know what, next time a ship is on its way, let's delay its arrival. We'll make sure it anchors out at an island, or they air out the goods, you know, in a building. Maybe they anchor in the bay and just don't come into the city. And if we give it the space and time that it needs, then we'll see if the infection still gets here once we actually go out and collect everything off the ship. And so that attempt to, they didn't know what the disease was. They didn't have modern medicine. They didn't know that it was a flea or that it was a microbe that was spreading the Black Death. But yet this quarantine, the attempt to delay something coming into the city, was a really nice, rational experiment. It allowed them to see that something was on that boat. They didn't know what it was, but they could do this again and again and protect themselves. And so it was only centuries later, of course, that they figured out germ theory and understood exactly how diseases were transmitted. And so quarantine was this really ingenious way of just using space and time as a kind of medical barrier, and it worked, and it still works.
But anyway, were there some abuses through history, ways in which quarantine was used punitively, particularly among certain segments of the population?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's one of the risks of it. I mentioned that because of the suspicion and the uncertainty involved, you can just say, hey, these people might have a disease, and so we're going to seal them off. And you do see that throughout history. Venice, Italy, where quarantine was really kind of perfected, they have three really beautiful permanent quarantine facilities there. And quarantine is really closely associated with the history of Venice. It's also the same city that invented the ghetto, where they actually put the entire city's Jewish population and locked them on an island at night so that they wouldn't be able to leave. These actual locked gates kept them inside. And then, of course, you see it, as recently as about a little more than a century ago, there was actually a bubonic plague outbreak in San Francisco. And it was blamed on the Chinese. And so the city's Chinatown was actually roped off and quarantined to the point where even white-owned businesses that were in Chinatown were left out of the quarantine. And so that led to a lawsuit and, protests and actually a successful court case that pointed out that this was a racist and motivated by bias, not medical expertise. And so quarantine, throughout the centuries has really kind of been not just abused, but constantly made a little bit better. For every time that we do it wrong, I'm trying to be optimistic historically, we learn from our mistakes and make it a little better for the next time.
But, this didn't, you could have probably written a book just completely on fictional accounts of quarantine, because those are quite numerous too, aren't they?
They are, actually. One of the things that was interesting, is even just about, I think it was 2008, there was a new horror movie that came out that was about an apartment building in Los Angeles where an infectious disease breaks out. And, the title of the movie was just Quarantine, as if the very word, made it clear that this is a horror movie, that this is about something creepy and exotic and badly understood. But you can see quarantine in fiction, going back to things like Edgar Allan Poe. He wrote the story, The Mask of the Red Death, that was about the richest people in a society isolating themselves inside a giant palace and actually welding the door shut and thinking that they've gotten away from this plague that is ravaging the world outside. But unbeknownst to them, they've actually locked themselves in with the disease. And so at the end of the story, one of the people at the party reveals himself to be infected, and soon everybody inside the palace dies. But you see it even in myths. It goes back to myths about Alexander the Great, allegedly constructed these gigantic gates out in the middle of the Caucasus region of Asia. And, those gates were the dividing line between, the Christian white European West and or what became the Christian white European West and this kind of monstrous Asian Far East. And that those gates, were used as a metaphor and a folktale to explain sort of, the origin of races and the origin of cultures and how we got to the world. And that's also a story then of, isolation and quarantine and just how things are divided or held separate.
Jeff Maynall is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He and partner Nicola Twilley spent years researching both real-world and fictional accounts of quarantine for the book that is now called Until Proven Safe, The History and Future of Quarantine, which was supposed to be released about the time that COVID-19 was causing lockdowns. So change the title of the book, certainly. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about quarantine and what it means and how it's been used over the years and how it might be used in the future. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Jeff, I want to ask about your time at the library in Venice with Luigi Bertinotto. And I have I borrowed the picture off of a building blog they use on our website to talk about today's discussion. What is going on there?
That was actually a fascinating night. We met up with the man you mentioned, Dr. Luigi Bertinotto, who at the time, this was before COVID-19, Was the former director of health for the entire Veneto region of Venice. You know, that region of northeastern Italy. And he later, several years later, when COVID hit, it became the head scientific advisor to the nation's COVID-19 response. So we had a nice kind of inside track there to learn about how Italy responded. But yeah, what you're describing in that photograph was funny, actually. You know, we spent several hours with Luigi. And then all of a sudden, after the library had closed and after we had discussed quarantine for hours, he revealed that inside his bag the entire time, he had actually specially made a costume that was the old plague outfit that doctors during the Black Death would wear. Most people will have seen this and maybe don't know exactly what it is or why it looks the way it is, but it's a very sinister and very creepy looking costume. You put on basically a black robe that makes you look like you're going to a funeral. And then you've got this really weird beak-shaped mask. The beak is about 2 feet long and comes back to the mask that has these sort of vacant black eyes. The purpose of that beak, as creepy as it is to see, was actually quite interesting. What they did was at the end of the beak, there's a little breathing hole, and they would pack that full of things like fragrant herbs, potpourri, even garlic. And then that would filter the air that they breathed so that they could walk around the city and visit patients and visit people who might have the bubonic plague and remain, at least they thought, somewhat safe, but certainly not having to smell the horrible smells of just people dying in the streets. And then he also had, Luigi Bertinotto also had in his bag, modern plague gear. So I got to dress up inside what we now call PPE, personal protective equipment. Complete with, a Tyvek suit, with an N95 respirating mask, with goggles, gloves, et cetera, et cetera. And this is what Luigi himself used to wear when he went to help with Ebola patients in West Africa. And so the photograph is a nice kind of, it shows the modern way that people dress when they go into plague areas, and then a 600-year-old version of that. So it was a nice kind of, way of contrasting, but also seeing some of the similarities with how humans gear up and they put on different suits and they go into the danger zone. And so, yeah, that's a photograph that's in the book.
Yeah, and we have it on our website as well at jeffexchange.org. It's interesting to think in terms of, like, they were doing the best they knew how to do at the time, as are we.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, that's just one of the ways that science progresses. Sometimes you realize that maybe you got it wrong at first, but you incorporate that feedback or that data and you make the response better next time. And so I think every society does that kind of thing. And, we saw that with COVID-19, a lot of the initial advice that we got from public health authorities was wrong. They didn't know how COVID was transmitted. They didn't necessarily know if it was on surfaces or if it was in the air, if we should wear masks or not wear masks. And unfortunately, that's just how science works and that's how medicine works. You don't necessarily know at first and then you figure it out. But that kind of thing, I think, fed into a lot of the early conspiracy theories, that this idea that, they don't know what they're talking about, they're making it up, they keep changing the guidance based on politics. Some of that is true. Politics affects a lot of these decisions. But at the same time, we have to give public health authorities the benefit of the doubt and let them figure out exactly what it is that we're facing. These are new diseases. They spread in new ways, and we don't know how to protect ourselves from them. And that's why quarantine is still useful.
You write that quarantine requires uncertainty, though, and that really is the point of it, though. I mean, you're putting people in this place because you're not sure if they are sick or not.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, that's one of the reasons, too, why people react negatively to it. The uncertainty is not a lot of people like it. They want to know what they're doing works. They want to know that what they're doing has a purpose or that there's actually something happening. It's not just a placebo or just some sort of ritual that they're being told, stay at home or stay in your hotel room. And I think that if we can give people a better understanding of uncertainty and that there is actually a reason for quarantine and that, you are in fact doing something, you're doing something that's better for public health. You're helping to protect yourself, but also your neighbors. You're helping to protect your grandparents or people who are immunocompromised. I think if you were better, not you, but if public health authorities were better at communicating what quarantine is doing, I think people would be much less apprehensive about it, and it wouldn't be quite so, it wouldn't inspire so much fear.
With your interest in architecture, Jeff, and the built environment, you've been running Building Blog for getting close to 20 years now. Did this book essentially start with the structures of quarantine, the lazarettos and stuff?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. And to a certain extent, it really did. My interest in architecture really brought me to look at quarantine facilities, which are mostly ruins now. They're either ruins, or they've been torn down altogether, or they are transformed into something else. And Nikki, my wife, we wrote the book together. We were actually in Australia about quite a long time ago now, about 12 years ago. And we noticed that there was an old quarantine station that had been turned into a hotel. and it was actually that experience that kind of led us and led me to start looking into the architecture of quarantine, where ironically, our initial question was, what was quarantine? What was this thing they used to do? They clearly don't do it anymore. Otherwise, this would still be a quarantine station. It wouldn't have been turned into a hotel. And all those quarantine stations around the Mediterranean, they'd still be standing, or they wouldn't be. Now they're made into art centers or bars or that kind of thing. And so initially, we really thought that quarantine was something that we might write a history of, that something that had disappeared and was no longer, used as a medical tool. But then, surely enough, there's still architecture, there's still quarantine buildings all over the world, including, I think you mentioned in the beginning, a brand new one in Omaha, Nebraska that we also got to visit.
Yeah, let's talk about that one a bit as we head up to this break here. The idea that there actually is a U.S. quarantine facility, and it just opened, didn't it, at the beginning of the COVID pandemic?
Yeah, ironically, it opened about 2 days before Americans were repatriated from cruise ships, with COVID-19. So it was, it opened just in the nick of time. We got to tour it about 6 months before COVID, when it was still under construction. And, one of the things that's just kind of ironic about the facility is that it's very high tech. It's well designed. It's a very comfortable place. It's on the campus there in Omaha. And but the ironic thing is that it has 20 beds. So it was built for quarantine, but it was inspired by Ebola, because Ebola was the most recent pandemic. And Ebola was what was giving people their lessons, like, this is what we need to do for quarantine. This is how we need to design our facilities. This is how we need to keep patients separate. But so when COVID-19 hit, where you have mass respiratory spread, a facility that only has 20 beds, when you're talking about tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people, even just in one city, who might need to quarantine, it was an interesting example of how we tend to build facilities reflecting the previous pandemic. We get used to what we've experienced there, and the things that we prepare for are all based on what just happened. And so sometimes we're caught off guard when a new pandemic hits or a new disease emerges.
We'll cast the conversation to the future when we return to the Jefferson Exchange with Jeff Maynaw, the co-author with Nicola Twilley of Until Proven Safe, the History and Future of Quarantine. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. The topic for the hour is quarantine, which has become a much fresher topic than Jeff Maynaw and Nicola Twilley thought it would be when they embarked upon the topic years ago. They started long before the COVID pandemic to write the book that became Until Proven Safe, The History and Future of Quarantine. It's a conversation you're welcome to join on the Jefferson Exchange with your questions, your comments, your observations about quarantine and human response to health crises. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned visiting a bunch of structures built for quarantine, lazarettos and things like that, and some fairly extensive travel here. And I'm curious to know if each culture put its own distinctive spin on quarantine buildings, things beyond the decoration, functional things.
Yeah, I guess I'd say that there's a couple things there. I mean, culturally, you definitely see some additions that would change the way a building was structured. One would be if it was a very religious society. So, you know, going back to the Middle Ages and a little bit later in European history, one of the things that you'd notice with quarantine facilities was that there was a way for priests to perform mass or for people to engage in religious worship. So there would be additions to the building where, you know, a visiting priest could actually talk to the people in quarantine, you know, from a pulpit, maybe in the middle of the facility, or maybe from a kind of balcony or alcove where he could reach more people with his voice. So you would see that kind of thing, you know, a religious addition. Culturally, you definitely see some changes in terms of how people react to the quarantine. One of the things that changed over time was class and how people could pay for a better quarantine. And so, you know, that changes over time pretty dramatically, you know, where, you know, people at one point, there was a facility in Malta that we visited. And, you know, when people were undergoing quarantine for maritime trade in the Mediterranean in the 19th century, actually, you know, you could just pay for better accommodations. And so, you know, Hungarian merchants who were very well to do, in one place actually had a room that was so large they could play tennis in it. You know, and they had a fireplace and they had stuffed furniture. Whereas other people who couldn't afford that, sometimes they weren't even let off the ship. So they would have been out at sea for weeks at a time. And then they'd show up and be just 50 feet away from the shore, but they'd have to stay on the boat and wouldn't be able to leave, which was obviously a very frustrating and sometimes boring experience. But then I think that probably the biggest change that just happens is just simply as, you know, medical expertise changes over time. You know, we're able to do different things with our buildings. And so, you know, we can have more exact systems for air handling or for wastewater management. And so quarantine and medical isolation can just become more better managed experience and plus a tidier building.
Well, I want to give some credit here to John Howard, who worked about a few hundred years before you. And in some places you were retracing his steps. Tell us about him and what it was he was seeking.
Yeah, he was a fascinating guy. We have a chapter in the book that really kind of follows John Howard around Europe. He was an 18th century British prison reformer who was really motivated by a sense that we needed to make buildings better. We needed to make them more morally and ethically tuned to the people in them. And he was primarily focused on prisons and jails and dungeons. And he became kind of notorious around Europe because he would just show up in France or Germany or Italy and demand entry to prisons and jails and then critique what he saw. You know, people didn't get enough bread or there were no windows or the floor was dirt and covered with water or whatever it might be. But along the way, he noticed that other people were kept in quarantine. And so he started becoming more interested in quarantine at the end of his life because quarantine stations were a lot like prisons. They just happened to have a medical purpose. And so John Howard began actually going all over Europe as far east as Russia and visiting quarantine stations and lazarettos and writing them up. And he was kind of like an early gonzo journalist. You know, one of the things that was incredible about him was that he began to realize that it wasn't enough just to knock on the door and get a tour, you know, to be officially welcomed as a guest and actually walk around and see these magnificent buildings and, you know, and write descriptions of them. He actually wanted to go into quarantine. And so at one point, he actually specifically found an infected boat, you know, with crew members who were suffering from, you know, various illnesses, including typhus, and sailed from what is now Turkey to Venice and actually was admitted into quarantine because he, too, had been potentially exposed to a disease. So in any case, it's a very long story. And he traveled, you know, just literally thousands and thousands of miles at a time when that was very difficult to travel that much. But we decided that we wanted to use him as a model and actually travel around Europe and visit some of the same places he had gone to, places like Malta and places like Venice, and really kind of see quarantine not only through his eyes, but from the eyes or through the eyes of like a 21st century version of John Howard or a 21st century quarantine tourist. And so that was what motivated one of the chapters of the book.
You mentioned going to most of the places you went to, the older ones were in ruins. I mean, was there one place that left a distinctive stamp on you for either its architecture or something it represented in the way human beings were treated in quarantine?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, as an architectural aficionado, like just a huge fan of you know, old ruined buildings, that travel was just a real thrill for me to do. I'd say there may be two examples. One would be this giant ruined quarantine station that was actually never finished. It's on an island off the coast of the city of Dubrovnik, and it's now just a bunch of walls kind of slowly collapsing in the woods. And what was interesting about that is that the reason they didn't finish it, it was because Dubrovnik authorities were actually worried that they would build such an impregnable lazaretto, you know, such a formidable quarantine station, that enemy invaders might actually sail into town, take over the lazaretto, and then have a fort, a fortress out on an island just offshore from Dubrovnik, and use it to launch a siege against them. And so there's something very interesting and ironic about a facility designed to protect the city being feared as a potential way for enemies to be fortified and actually attack that city. But I think Malta was probably the one that would stand out. Malta, of course, is an island in the Mediterranean. It's so far south that it's basically off the coast of Africa. And there was a huge facility there that we had traveled all the way to Malta to see, and then were almost locked out of because our guide, his keys no longer worked for the gates. And so Nikki and I actually had to climb over a series of fences and actually go into the lazaretto. The sun is going down. We were the only people in it. It's absolutely huge. And we just had the place to ourselves. So we got to explore old stairways and giant vaulted ceilings and all the different courtyards. And, we had been warned that parts of the lazaretto were dangerous and that we shouldn't go into them. It's an unstabilized ruin, so it's basically falling apart slowly over time. And so as we're running around in there together at sunset, you know, we realized that no one told us which parts of the lazaretto were dangerous and that we shouldn't go into. So that was just a very, very memorable experience and a great aspect of the research process that Nikki and I went through.
And there are pictures in the book, I should point out. You've already mentioned there are some photographs, and I just want to buttress that there are things to be seen in the book as well as to read about, including the tools of quarantine. I mean, I didn't even realize it until we got to the chapter on quarantine mail, but the idea that communications in those days got passed through several sets of hands, and there were some procedures there.
Indeed, yeah, that was another chapter that was fun. It sounds like an immensely boring subject. We're talking about disinfecting mail packages. But what was so interesting about that is that, you know, once you start looking into the logistics of that, you know, if you're going to send something from one country to another or from an infected area to a place that a disease hasn't emerged yet, you know, you have to take precautions. And so different European powers in particular came up with their own ways of disinfecting the mail. Slicing open envelopes or putting them on the equivalent of a steam iron. In other cases, puncturing them with these devices that look more like medieval torture tools, and then fumigating the envelope from within. And so you see a bunch of really interesting things there. We tagged along briefly with a group in North London called the Disinfected Mail Study Circle.
I love that name.
But what they've done is they've actually found, you know, previously forgotten outbreaks that medical historians have overlooked, but you can still find traces in the mail system. But then we still do it. That was the other interesting thing, is that after 9/11 and then even during COVID-19, we still do these kinds of things. You know, we irradiate packages that go to certain zip codes in Washington, D.C. out of fear that there might be another anthrax attack. When COVID-19 first hit, there was a lot of chatter online about how to disinfect your packages. You know, should you wipe down everything you get from Amazon? Should you have hand sanitizer ready if you touch the mail? These questions are quite interesting, and they touch on some of the fears of transmission. You know, we don't know how something is transmitted, and so we take steps to protect ourselves. And mail disinfection is one of those things, and it goes back centuries.
And there's another practice in here that I didn't even know about a buffer zone set up in 1770 in what was then the Austro-Hungarian Empire. What was that about?
Yeah, that was really interesting as well. So the cordon sanitaire, as it was called, you know, a sanitary cordon, was implemented and it spanned hundreds of miles. It was actually an armed border region. And so there were lookouts stationed, almost like a military draft. You had to do this. So you would be stationed in one of these lookout towers. Each one was a rifle shot away from the next, and you were meant to just look for people who were trying to get into that part of Europe, coming from effectively what was the Ottoman Empire at the time. And the fear was that they would be bringing disease. They might be bringing cholera, or they might be bringing the Black Death, they might be bringing typhus, you know, whatever the disease might be, was being held at bay. But what's interesting is that, you know, that practice, that idea of, you know, using an entire region as a quarantine line, you know, still has effects. It has economic effects in terms of that region wasn't particularly well developed economically. It's even had psychological effects. And you mentioned this earlier about fiction and stories. It even affected the European imagination. And so when you go into the history of vampire folktales, that same region is basically ground zero for the origin of vampire folktales. You know, the Transylvanian mountains, this idea of someone who is both living and dead. All of these things can be sort of tracked back to this fear of an emerging monstrous other who has this disease and is on the way and is coming through this region in southeastern Europe. And, you know, we have to be vigilant and watch for them. And that kind of thing still has effects. And as you mentioned, you know, this was in the 1700s. So, you know, we have 300 years later, we're still dealing with the effects of this kind of large-scale quarantine line. And so it really shows that the history of quarantine is not only very, it's still effective, it's still changing things today, but it's also, the kind of thing where you can really find quarantine everywhere.
So let's talk about comparisons then. I mean, pre and post pandemic, or well, we're not quite post pandemic as we talk here, but the things you and Nicola learned prior to COVID and from the pandemic itself. I just wonder if some things might have changed greatly in your perceptions or Nicola's about quarantine and how the history matches into the present and future.
Well, so many things have actually stayed similar, which is quite interesting. You know, the shape of our buildings, our quarantine buildings, has changed over time, and yet the basic practice, you know, separating people into rooms or having courtyards or separating people from merchandise, these kinds of things, you know, would still have the same kinds of effects. And then the suspicion, the lack of trust of authorities, those kinds of things are still around. But what was interesting, I think, was just watching the city. We live in Los Angeles, just for reference, but watching the city try to adapt itself for a COVID-19 world. And so, you know, I mean, I'm sure you saw the same thing where you live, but, you know, all of a sudden everything was covered in tape. You know, it was marking where you're allowed to stand and where you shouldn't stand. Grocery stores suddenly turned into one-way routes. You know, if you forgot to buy something, you had to go back to the beginning. You couldn't just turn around,
right?
At least here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
Yeah.
All right, so you point out in the end of the book, quarantine can and must be, and there are quite a few ways that you list here under the can and must be category, but including culturally reclaimed as an act of personal responsibility. Talk about what the goal is there and possible steps to achieve that.
Well, yeah, so what we tried to do at the end of the book was just remind people that when you're asked to quarantine, it's not just an imposition on your life or a taking away of your liberties. It's a request that you do something for the greater good. You know, it's taking on responsibility to not spread the disease to people who might not be able to fight that disease. You know, if you're healthy, one of the resistances that you heard to quarantine was, you know, this isn't going to affect me. You know, I'm a healthy person in my 30s. Why do I need to stay home? But it isn't about you. It's about the other people who you're acting to protect. And so, you know, there are several things that we recommend at the end of the book, but one of those is just a cultural reframing of quarantine to remind people that you're being asked to do something for other people. This isn't just about you anymore. This is about the public. This is about your neighbors. This is about people, strangers who you may never meet, other people's parents, other people's kids, and taking on that responsibility seriously. We also point out that governments, though, also need to take this seriously. If the government is going to say you can't run your business or you can't leave your house or you can no longer go into the park to walk your dog, the government needs to take on a what we call a duty of care. It needs to take responsibility for that. It can't just ask you to do something and then leave you to fend on your own. And so we also look at the steps that a government can take to be more responsive to the people that it's demanding the sacrifice from. And that might mean wage replacements, or it might mean free testing. There's any number of ways to deal with that, but that's a very important step. You know, the state has to step a little bit more in our direction if it expects us to quarantine.
So the whole process that led to the book began well before COVID, but COVID certainly changed it. It is the work of Jeff Maynaugh and Nicola Twilley from Los Angeles. The book is Until Proven Safe, The History and Future of Quarantine. Jeff Maynaugh, thanks so much for sharing with us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.